Good morning, this is Darren Rouse from ProBlogger. It's great to have you with us. I should say good evening for some of you. I know many of you are listening in from the US where it's somewhere late afternoon, early evening, and I know there are a few of you in Europe who are staying up very late for this, 1, 2 a.m. I know a number of you have just emailed me to say. So if you do get a little tired and you can't hang with us the whole time, be assured we are recording. I just hit the record button. And 99% of the time it actually works. So we'll send you out a link in the next day or two with the recording. Our hashtag today you should see on the screen is PB Webinar. I notice a number of you are already tweeting away. If something resonates with you, please do tweet it, pass it on. These are free webinars and we really want the goodness from them to go beyond just those listening in today. So if you do have any questions today, we have the opportunity to ask those. There is a little question box on your GoToWebinar panel there, and you can pop them in at any time. They'll only be seen by Jasmine, who works with me and myself, and later on in this session, we will open up for some Q&A. So we will be drawing on those questions. If this is your first webinar, you can sign up to be notified of new ones at problogger.net/webinars. We, at the moment, are promoting these webinars to the full ProBlogger list, but we're fast approaching the time where we won't do that anymore because we're getting too many people showing up. So this will be the only way that we'll get notice out of these webinars. So today we are interviewing Sarah Wilson. I know those of you who are in Australia will probably know Sarah quite well. She's an Aussie media personality, journalist, blogger who has appeared in many television shows, on radio, magazines, newspapers and online. I wrote a very long introduction for her today because she's done so much and I'm trying to chop it down now as we go, but she was the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, the host of the first series of MasterChef Australia, and the highest rating show in Australian TV history. I think that was probably the first time I took note. I'd never read Cosmo, Sarah, but I was a bit of a MasterChef fan, I have to say. And she's also written over 100 weekly columns in Sunday Life, which is an Australian magazine insert in some of Australia's largest newspapers. She's a health coach, and I think it was in 2009, started blogging at sarahwilson.com.au, where she's more recently launched a couple of ebooks on quitting sugar, which have helped 20,000 or so people, I think, get off the sweet stuff, and has more recently released an e-cookbook, which we'll be talking about later today. Sarah is also keynoting the Melbourne ProBlogger training event, which we're holding later this year. So welcome, Sarah. Sorry about the long intro, but you've just achieved too much, I think.
I'm sorry to have to bore all your listeners with my CV.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so we've got the next 45 minutes or so to ask Sarah about her experience, particularly online. So perhaps, Sarah, if you could take us back to the start. Did you actually start in 2009? Was that the start of the blog?
Yeah, I'm shocking with timelines, but I think it was around about then. It was when I was still hosting MasterChef. I had a bit of downtime sitting in the shipping container that served as a green room out the back, and just thought I'd try out this blogging business. It sort of started out as just a couple of little posts. I was experimenting. And then, of course, I started the Sunday Life column, I think around about the same time. So it was a way for that content to then be available to, you know, online to sort of a broader audience. And, you know, as with all of these things, it was an experiment. And the experiment just kept growing.
Yeah. So when you started, did you start with, we've already got people asking, was it blogger.com or WordPress or what sort of?
WordPress.
Yep,
it was WordPress. I did customize the template. I had, you know, sort of a young designer who I'd met through bike riding, which is one of the things I blog about, of course. And he said, oh, you know, I'll design you a little logo. And my background in editing magazines meant that I can be a bit of a control freak. I'm a frustrated graphic designer, I think, at times. So most of the things that have been on my blog or in my ebooks, the design-wise, I've kind of orchestrated, generally with somebody who's a young reader of my blog or whatever, and I support them and I sort of say, look, you know, let's work with this, let's work with that. So, yes, it was WordPress. I did customize it slightly. And like I say, I mean, I really didn't think it would take off. And I, you know, registered my URL quite some time ago. And I really couldn't think of a better name. And I thought, I'll go to start off with sarahwilson.com.au. And ever since, I don't think a day or a week goes by where I don't think maybe I should change my domain name. You know, It sort of all seems a bit narcissistic. And I think I've spoken to you about it, Darren, before. You know, is it just ridiculous staying with my name? Should I have a better name? Most people say no, which is interesting. Most people say no, just stick with what you've done, which I think is the beauty of online. People get used to ideas very, very quickly. And it just, you know, like I say, things just keep growing. They grow from something small, and as long as the right energy is there, it'll just keep growing.
Yeah. So how would you describe your blog today in terms of niche or topic? A lot of people have already asked questions around what is your niche and how do you choose a niche? What was that like for you? Did you choose a topic strategically, or did your niche choose you because it's just who you are?
Yeah, it chose me, definitely. It started off, I guess, I mean, I did have that tagline, A Sweeter Life, which is ironic because it was quite some time later that I got into the whole quitting sugar kind of thing. But yes, I guess the premise behind me blogging was that I wanted to share content and information about having a better life. And this dream, funnily enough, evolved when I was 12. This is how I got into media in the first place. And if I can backtrack slightly, I think it will actually explain a little bit why I blog, how I blog, and what's worked. When I was 12, I used to listen to a program on ABC Radio National, which is an Australian national program on the government-funded broadcaster, and it was called Life Matters, and there was also another program called The Search for Meaning, both of which were kind of spiritual, how to make life better kind of programs. I was obsessed. My mother, and I told my mum that I was going to host Life Matters when I was older. And I kind of forgot about it, and it wasn't until I did another webinar sometime later where somebody was interviewing me about the fact that I'd done TV, magazines, and radio. Oh, sorry, and radio was the one thing I hadn't done. And I said, well, that's funny because that was always my lifelong dream. So going full circle is kind of where I've ended up, and it's blogging that has enabled me to do that. So, yes, when I started out the blog, whether I knew it or not, I had an essence or a mission, you know. I really wanted to share content that could maybe help make people's lives better and make my own life better and use it as a way for me to experiment with things that made life better. Then, of course, the column happened at the same time, which picked up on a similar theme. And it just sort of grew from there. And as a result, as you said, the content found me. As I sort of developed more and more interests, and people then kind of grabbed onto things. So the sugar thing is certainly part of it. The health, you know, I think it's got a health slant. I think it's also very much about how to make life better. That's the vibe of my blog. But I don't get too prescriptive. I really do try to keep it natural. And I try to write about what interests me. And it's kind of like my adage is you build it and they'll come. You know, if I write about stuff that I'm really interested in and I create content that excites me, then people will follow my blog and I'll be able to sort of, you know, keep growing from there. I don't worry too much about what everybody else wants. I really try to write about what I want to share.
Great. So tell us a little bit about your approach to generating content. Is it something that you plan ahead, or is it very spontaneous? Sit down at the computer and here's what I'm going to write about today. How do you come up with ideas?
Again, it's so organic. I mean, I remember you, Darren, once described to me your blog as a sort of a house with a whole heap of extensions and annexes, and it sort of all seems quite chaotic, but it forms a house somehow, you know. That's kind of how I operate as well. Yes, I do work with a little bit of a plan, and again, that's evolved. I have food content every Tuesday. And readers have got to know that. I think some kind of routine and regularity is a really good thing. So Tuesday is food content, either a recipe or anything to do with food. I used to blog 5 days a week. I've actually pulled that back to 3 or 4, due to a whole heap of other kind of time constraints, to be honest. And that's just what feels right for me at the moment. Might grow again to 5 or 6, you know, days a week. But I tend to have about 20 to 30 blog posts that are ideas in the making that I've put into drafts, and I'll often sort of bang out an idea that I'm really passionate about and then go, oh, I'm not quite ready to blog that yet. That doesn't really feel like it's sitting right. And it might sit there for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then I'll go back to it and go, yep, that feels right today. And that's generally how I operate, a week in advance. So I'll sort of know what I'm doing on the Tuesday for Wednesday, Thursday. You know, I'll work on the blogs on the Monday and the Tuesday, and sometimes even I'll write it that morning and bump the other one along. It really does for me need to operate based on how I'm feeling and whether I feel that the information is appropriate. And I know this sounds really airy-fairy, and for those of you who don't know me or don't follow my blog, I live in Byron Bay, which is got a bit of a hippie, you know, sort of angels and amethysts kind of reputation. So what I'm going to say sounds very Byron Bay, but I do think that it's really important to sort of put out blog posts that feel like they're the right thing for everybody on that day. And I don't know how I quite do that, but it just kind of evolves that way. And it's incredible how many people go, oh my God, that is exactly what, you know, I'm going through this morning. And I think you've got to allow that flexibility. I think you can plan to a certain extent, but you've also got to allow for that really intuitive kind of approach, because why else are we doing this? If we're blogging because we just want to churn out information like a second-rate newspaper, I don't think it's ever going to be fun or, you know, or successful. But if we blog for the authentic, for authentic reasons, and because we really are feeling like we need to, you know, to share this information, then you're kind of never going to fail. And so I really have to come back to that, and I come back to it as often as I can. You know, I often, like I'm sure many of you listening out there, go, why am I doing this? You know, I've blogged now for 3 years, and I'm sure we'll touch on the monetization of it in a moment, but I haven't been paid for all of that work. And I often do wonder why I'm doing it. But I guess if I come back to my principles and this idea of authenticity, it does make sense. It makes sense, and yeah, it means I can keep going.
That's so good. I find I'm quite often will just I plan quite a long way in advance, a week, 2 weeks. On ProBlogger, we're planning a month in advance, but sometimes there's a post that you just got to shove out right now. It's the wrong time of day. It's just you just know you've got to put it up, and they're often the ones that connect and click. And I think it's partly the way you write it because you're writing with passion and feeling. And I don't know, maybe just the planets align for your readers as well a little bit, and it just
I
seems
do think so.
to click.
I totally agree. And I'll tell you what, when I write a post, which is I call it sort of my information-packed posts. You know, it might be, I don't know, 10 ways with chia seeds, or why you should eat, you know, blah blah blah. You know, food storage tips, or whatever it might be. You know, they're often posts, and I'll confess this, that, you know, I'll have a really busy week, and I'll go, oh my God, I haven't got anything for Wednesday. And I'll have a few of those posts in the pipeline that I've written when I've had a bit of spare time, and they'll go in. And I tell you what, I mean, they really don't get a lot of feedback. You know, I really notice the difference. I notice the difference in hits that day, in comments, you know, in Twitter shares. If my heart's not in it, then the whole world's heart isn't in it, and it's dramatic, the difference between the you know the two styles of posts that I write. But you know, as you know, Darren, there are days where you just need to have the consistency out there, and you know you do need to put content out there. I cringe every now and then when I do it, but I think that consistency is important in blogging. So you know, I have to weigh up the pros and cons, I suppose.
Can you think of a post or two that really connected with your audience? Really interested to see different blogs, certain types of posts seem to really hit the mark more than not. We've talked about posts that you feel something about, but is there a type of post that seems to always
There
hit the
is.
mark?
Yeah, absolutely. Funnily enough, the most searched item on my blog is for quinoa, which is random because I think I've only done about five posts on quinoa, but that speaks to the popularity of that particular ingredient. Leaving that aside, I think it's the posts that are probably most sort of reflective of my blog, and that is, I think if I was to define what my blog, my sort of, unique selling point, it would probably be the fact that I get very personal. I share a lot of information that I always like to think digs down an extra dozen layers in terms of emotion. And I don't know why I do it. I'm a very reserved, private person in many ways, but I guess I've always had this urge to really share what is going on in my heart, and I even dig deeper than just the first layer of my heart. I try to really feel it when I write it. When I access that space, and some days I just can't, but when I can access that really deep connected space where I can, again, I'm going to sound Byron Bay, but I can feel the humanity, around me, then I get a lot of feedback. I get people contacting me in a way that makes my life feel worthwhile, where people say, I feel the same way, and they share what they're feeling. It actually takes them down to that really deep level, that really, as close as you can to that really, oh, how can I put it, vulnerable flutter that is at the core of all of us. And so when I can do that, then yeah, they're the posts that do really well. So I'll write about how I feel loneliness a lot. I'll write about how I have fraud complex. I feel that, I'm never gonna, like that I'm getting life completely wrong. It's that kind of stuff. I often refer to it as, that feeling when you come home and you may have had been at a loud party and you've been on, rah, rah, rah. You get home, you stare in the mirror, it might be midnight, it's quiet in the bathroom, and you look at yourself in the eyes and you suddenly see yourself really clearly. I always want to act that access that space, it's those kind of very private, lonely, vulnerable spaces. Yeah, and I think that's definitely what I think get the biggest response from readers.
Sure. Interesting you brought up privacy. It was my next question. The private moments. I guess you're talking about private feelings and things. You also, from time to time, Instagramming your road trips and your life is kind of out there to a degree. Where's the line between public and private for you? Or is there one?
Oh, it's a really tricky one, and I dance around it. I dance backwards and forwards. It's a bit of a waltz that I do, and I struggle with it, but I also, in the struggle, I come to terms with it on a regular basis, and I feel quite good about it, I suppose. It's taken me a long time to feel good about it. As a traditional journalist, I studied as a, I did a cadetship with News Limited. I've come up through the ranks of traditional journalism, where there is a real, unless you're an opinion writer, you keep a very, big distance between yourself and the reader. You report the facts, you're impartial, and so on. So I've come up through that culture, and oversharing has always been frowned upon within, traditional media. That, of course, is changing. And I obviously also came up through the ranks as an opinion writer. So I had an opinion column in Melbourne's Herald Sun, the Sunday Herald Sun, and the Daily Telegraph from quite a young age. From I think I was 20, 25 or 26. For those who are Melbourne listeners, I shared a page with Andrew Bolt, which was quite interesting. There was quite a He's a very conservative opinion writer in Australia, so that was a learning process, I suppose. But I guess I've had to grapple with this idea of the public versus private from that opinion writing. Then coming into the sort of blogging sphere, it takes it to a whole new level, and I try to share information that I think helps people, helps a cause, helps humanity. I think when you can put yourself out on a limb and share something, that will help other people or inspire other people, then that's a good thing. If you're doing it because you're wanting attention, or you're wanting to do just a hey me kind of, you know, I went to the fridge and had a Tim Tam kind of, you know, tweet or whatever, then I don't really know that you're adding much to life. And that's sort of where I try to draw the line. I mean, occasionally I'll write a tweet or an Instagram and I'll go, oh, God, is this actually furthering things? But, you know, generally I find that there is something that I am trying to give. Now, for instance, a road trip, I am really hell-bent on getting people out exploring Australia and, you know, not staying home at weekends or going to a shopping mall. I mean, as you probably know, Darren, I'm very anti-consumerist. I want people to have experiences. So if I can show people that I went bushwalking and that I don't make a big fuss of it, you don't have to have lots of equipment, it's only an hour from your house or whatever, then that's really important to me. So I will share information and try to inspire people to do it. At the same time, I also try to be responsible about it, you know, and to be open and authentic about it and not give false images. Hard with Instagram, because really, is there a bad photo of yourself on Instagram? but I do try to do it in quite an open way. But I struggle, Darren, constantly with the public versus private thing. And just recently on Twitter, I got, you know, hauled over the coals by a few followers who felt that I wasn't engaging enough with them, and I, you know, they wanted me to follow them. You know, Twitter for me is not the forum for that, and I had to pull back on following personal friends and sort of celebrities. I use Twitter, and I'd like to touch on this in a moment actually about creating boundaries, but I use Twitter for my news feeds. You know, I use Facebook for friends. I use Instagram for a bunch of other things. And I think that's really important, is to know where your boundaries are within each social media medium. And, you know, a few people on Twitter get annoyed with that I don't necessarily engage on a personal level on Twitter, but that's not what I use Twitter for. Mm. So I've had to kind of wrangle with this, you know, for the last 3 years. And I think we all do. I think we're all trying to find the right sort of space personally, you know, and I don't know if you've probably followed him during the Writers' Festival here, and I've forgotten his name, but he has written about publicness and the benefits of publicness, the idea that, you know, and this particular guy, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, I think it's Jeff Jarvis, he's a professor at MIT.
Yep.
He really sees the value of putting yourself out on a limb. He tweeted about his prostate cancer, so everybody got to know the health of his penis very, very well. And as an academic, he struggled with it, trying to find the right line. But he felt that it was really important to share that information because it was helping a lot of blokes, you know, and it got a lot of other people engaged. So I think we are getting a lot more used to it. I'm getting a lot more used to it, but I have to find my own way, and I am constantly finding my own way. It's a constant experiment.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about finding readers, because it's all very good to create content, but if no one's reading it, that kind of makes you a little bit sad as a blogger, I find. And it's yes. Certainly having lots of readers isn't everything, but how did you find those first readers for your blog back when you started out? And have you, is it something that's strategic, or is it just something that, again, has happened in an organic way for you?
I think at first you do a few strategic things. I actually, to be honest, can't remember exactly how it all happened. I think I had the leg up because once I started my Sunday Life column, which is sort of, you know, a couple of months into blogging, it had the URL at the bottom, so that probably did boost numbers, but I don't think all that dramatically. I think I used my basic social media outlets at the time. I was also on Twitter. I got onto Twitter reasonably early, I think. So I was using that. But it's kind of like, I mean, a lot of people ask me, you know, how do you get numbers? You know, what was your strategy and everything? How do you, you know, conquer social media? You know, a lot of old school media people ask me that. And I said, you know what, there's only one way, and that is to enter the fray. Get in there and be in the mess of it, make mistakes, you know, learn from other people. And this is how I actually became an opinion writer. This is how I developed my own personal style of writing. I also get asked by young journalist students about the same thing. I studied ferociously. I used to go and get all the international papers, find the columnists whose writing I absolutely love, clip the papers, because back in those days there was no online. The internet sort of arrived halfway through my, I think, first or second year in journalism. And I would go home on the weekend and study their writing. Until I worked out what it was that worked, what I loved about, certain styles of writing, and I developed my own style through that. I did the same with social media. I used to just sit online and, follow people like yourself, Darren. I used to follow your stuff. I would follow all these big bloggers, and, I eventually found the people whose spirit I really liked, and I found myself wanting to read their stuff. Zen Habits, Leo from Zen Habits was somebody I followed for quite some time, and, I worked out what worked, and I used a few of their strategies. I'd try them for myself, and then go, "Nah, that feels grubby. It doesn't feel like it's me." And I guess I just tried these little things. I mean, I have veered away from some of those strategies, and I'm sure your listeners know about these. Where you put a number, 23 things that, blah blah blah. I use that te those techniques a little bit for the, to get up there in the Google rankings. But over time, I've backed away from that. I do want people to read my blog, but I want them to read it for the right reasons, because otherwise they won't stay. And again, I keep going back to it. If you're authentic, then people will come. And it takes a bit of patience. But if some of the best and biggest bloggers in the world haven't got celebrity profiles. They haven't done any sort of screaming billboards to get their readers. They've just done their thing. And people have found that they've gravitated towards it because it's the right energy, it's authentic. I believe with the internet, you can smell if somebody is authentic or not. And I'm sure you know what I mean, Darren. You follow somebody on Twitter or on their blog for a while, and you suddenly start to feel this kind of irky feeling when their avatar pops up, because the content's not right, it doesn't feel genuine, and you find yourself unfollowing them. That happens to me all the time, and I think it's because it's at that point that they're probably not working from their most authentic space. So yes, that's what I've done. I mean, I guess I've also, like I said, enter the fray. I also connected with a lot of bloggers. I think some of your followers would probably be aware of Gala Darling. She was a young girl who I got to write for me when I was at Cosmo. I used to follow her blog years and years ago. She's been a real supporter. I think having supporters, where you support their content and then they support yours, that's what social media should be about. It is about sharing the good stuff. And if you share other people's good stuff, it'll come back. It is the most honest, direct, I think, way of humans being able to communicate ever. Because like I said, you can smell when something's off, and you know what? You can drop off straight away. You don't have to stick around for the bad smell. And I think that's how blogs grow, And I think that's a great thing. It's great news for everybody out there. Keep doing your authentic thing, and the right stuff will come to you.
Okay, that's great. We're going to talk about monetization now, because we're getting lots of questions coming in around your ebooks and, but just quickly, how did you earn your first dollar online?
Oh gosh, what was it? Would have been an ad. Actually, look, there's three avenues that I earn my money from, and I probably should preface it with this. Firstly, ads, which are the smallest part, and I think they are for many bloggers, because ad revenue just hasn't got there yet for the blogging community. The second thing is, I leverage, and I always say this to people, how do you make money from blogging? Well, you've got to have something to leverage. So for me, I do a lot of MC work, and sort of hosting and that kind of stuff. And I've got to say, a lot of my career now pivots from my blog. So yes, 100% of my income now comes from my blog, but in kind of indirect ways. So people want, they book me to MC a cooking demonstration or whatever it might be, because they know that my blog has a following, and if I tweet and blog and Instagram about it, it'll get that extra layer of engagement. So it was possibly be from that, from an MC gig or whatever, people were wanting to tap into my my blog's message, you know, my brand that comes through my blog. And then, of course, the third thing, bring the ebooks.
Yeah. So let's focus in on the ebooks. We've talked about advertising in on other occasions, but why did you create that first one? It must have been a year and a half ago that I first saw it or started hearing you talk about an ebook. Why did you choose ebooks?
I guess I chose it. Again, it just evolved quite organically. I mean, I'll backtrack. It was actually a year and a half ago that I first quit sugar and I wrote about it for my Sunday Life column. And it was controversial, and it got a lot of, interest from people. I then became obsessed by it, and I guess my blog is an outpouring of my various obsessions. I tend to get quite nerdy and really interested in things, and which is why a blog's great. You know, it's an outpouring of all of that. But I started to investigate it further, and I realised, David Gillespie, who is an Australian author who'd written a book, and called Sweet Poison. I spoke to him, and I read his book, and I felt that there was probably there was a need for the average person to be given a program for quitting sugar, the average person who's not necessarily obese, not necessarily a complete sugar addict, they might not be drinking soft drink every day, so for people like me. And I sort of looked into it, what worked, what didn't work. I researched, I shared the information, and a whole heap of blog posts, resulted from that. And it sort of became every week, every fortnight, I was posting some new material on it. And then I realised I had sort of quite a lot of material there, and a lot of people were asking me, for a program. How do I do it? Oh, I know you've written about it, but I can't find it. I can't be bothered. And I thought, well, maybe I should just put all this together. And in fact, Darren, I remember ringing you and going, what's the best way to do this? And you actually gave me some really good advice. You sort of said, look, because I was feeling really funny about the idea of taking content that I'd already written about on my blog, duplicating it into an ebook. And I remember you sort of saying, look, that's fine, because people want all the information together. Not everyone has the time to trawl through blog posts, So I actually took the content from my blog that was resonating and working and expanded from there and, provided recipes, and turned it into an 8-week program, It was a layering approach. I thought I might sell a couple of hundred copies. I thought I might sell enough just to cover my costs, but at least I'd have something out there for people who were constantly asking me for the program. Now, it then went on to sell big time. And if I, and I know, Darren, you'd relate to this, if I'd known it'd do so well, I would have done it, completely differently. I would have had a different design. I would have, spent more time on it. But, of course, you never get that opportunity. And that's the wonderful thing, I think, about this e-world, is that you put it out there, it either resonates or it doesn't, and you can't have regrets. You can go back and make a few tweaks, and I did make a few tweaks at some point and re-released it, but you put it out there and it's appropriate for the times, and people either want it or they don't, and you can't have too many regrets. So, like I said, it evolved, it hit the right note, and I've just, the perfectionist that I am, I've just got to accept that, it was right for the times. Yeah. Now then the second one evolved in a similar way. So the first one was an 8-week program. The second one, which was released just a couple of weeks ago, is a cookbook. And again, I was getting so many requests from people wanting recipes. And I was putting stuff up on Instagram and Twitter of things I was cooking. I was trying to inspire people to eat more saturated fat, not be scared of butter. Try different ingredients that are sweet but don't contain fructose. And in that process, people were going, well, where's the recipe? And I'm like, oh, in my head. And so I kind of realised I had over 100 recipes. And I thought, well, I better do something about that. So that's how the second ebook evolved. And it was a completely different process to the first, because it was all, I'd learnt from the first one. Like I say, enter the fray, make a mess of it, be in the chaos, learn, come out the other end and do it differently the second time. So the second time was a far more professional approach, and the second ebook is a lot fancier, and I think you get quite a lot of bang for your buck in the second one. Again, there's lots of things I'd do differently, but it is what it is, and it's resonating.
Yep. Eric's asking, how do you go through the process of writing for you? How much of it was already up on the blog, and how much has been new? And did you lock yourself away in a room for 3 months, or is it something you
Oh, I
broke down
wish.
into steps?
I am quite chaotic. I have, well, look, I have organized chaos. I have a routine with my, well, I kind of have a routine with my writing, I suppose. Writing is something where you've got to get it, again, it's about entering the fray. I would often find that I would do my blog post and then I would then do my writing for my ebooks, or at the time, I should also point out, when I was writing the first ebook, I was also writing a old school, paper and ink version, or book, I should say, for a publishing company, which I think there's a moral in all of this. I wrote 65,000 words, spent 12 months writing it, and then decided to abort it because my ebooks were doing better and I was enjoying them more. So I don't know, I guess I'm a sign of the times in that respect. But with my writing, I find that I've got to get into the vibe of it. I can't just sit down and start banging stuff out because it won't come out authentically. So I'd often write a blog post which would open me up and get me kind of free, get me into the right tone. And then I would do the rest of my work for the day. So that's what works for me. I tend to work from 10 till 6. I do exercise. A lot of people who read my blog know that I've got a disease that means that I've got to manage my energy very carefully. And I do that by giving myself the morning to do exercise, meditate, and have time for myself. I then sit down and work. I've got an assistant who works with me, Jo, who's fantastic, and she worked with me to pull out all the blog posts that were about sugar. I then kind of got all the information, collated it, cut out bits that weren't relevant, and rejigged it. And then went, oh, I want to put this in, I want to put that in. It was again a layering approach until I got to the point I was happy with it. And as Seth Godin always says, eventually you've just got to press send, you've got to ship. And I did get to a point where I went, oh, you know what, this is good enough. My magazine background also enabled me to realize that it had to have a lot of visual, a lot of infographics. Writing is one thing, and this is some advice I would give to people, is especially with ebooks, it's not the same as writing blog posts or writing, say, a paper and ink version of a book. It's got to be succinct. It's got to be cut down into bite-sized pieces. It's got to help people. And there's a really there's I see this with a lot of writers. They kind of get into the prose and the guff, cut out the guff, get straight to the point. One tip I give to young writers, and I used to give this advice when I was at Cosmo, is when they were stuck, they couldn't quite get to the point. They were waffling around, I think there's the waffling around thing is a real problem. I always say, imagine you're sitting down with your friend at the pub after work and they say, well, what were you writing about today? Or what were you investigating today? Write what you would then tell them. And generally, when you're speaking to someone down at the pub, you tell them the most exciting thing first. You put the whole point of your day up first. You go, well, I was writing about how it only takes 8 weeks to quit sugar. And the reason is because of this, this, and this. I find that's a really good technique, is to pull back and imagine yourself doing that. And I have to do that a lot. I'll often walk away and go, well, what am I trying to say here? So with ebook writing, it's really important to get straight to the point. I think writing headlines, sort of subheads and things like that to organize your thinking. The other thing I do, Darren, which is very unorthodox, and I've written about this on my blog, is I draw my articles. Any blog post, anything I ever write, I have a piece of paper next to me with a pen and I kind of draw it. I call it drawing because I write out my points in sort of a logical order. So each point flows from one to the next. I have arrows and thought bubbles and dotted lines, and it sort of sits on one piece of paper and I can see that there is a flow and there's a logic, and I really recommend that to anyone. You might type it out, you might, I don't know, you might have your own sort of style for it. But it's really important, I think, with blogging and ebooks to have a logic. That's another tip that I really think is really important.
So, if you do have questions, be adding them into the question box. Those of you who are listening, well, I'm pulling most of those questions are actually what I'm using to ask these. This one's from Stuart. What sort of strategies were you using to market your ebooks? They obviously sold well.
Yeah.
Maybe two or three practical tips on marketing.
Okay.
It.
Yeah. I think one thing I'll say, and I'll give credit to Shane Tilley, who, Darren, I know you're familiar with, and you've co-authored a book with him, and I know that his marketing ebook is for sale on your site. I spoke to Shane, and Shane gave me a lot of tips. So tip one would be check out his ebook. And sort of, you know, it's a very dense book, but all the detail is there. The second point I would say is see your primary job after you've released an ebook as being stoking the fire. It is about finding layers and layers and layers, and whenever you think you're done, there'll be another layer of promotion that you can work to. And you know, I find it a lot of fun. You know, using your contacts. I have the benefit of having traditional media contacts, so I was able to sort of, you know, access those. But anybody who's working online and has a great community should be accessing other bloggers and supporters. And you know, giving them a whole bunch of books that they can give away. You know, having some great instructions and offers for other bloggers who can, you know, have three of copies of your book to give away, and you know, they'll of course then write a review post. That kind of thing is what works. Being generous, you know, within that as well. You know, having a generous affiliates program. At first, you might balk at the idea of giving away 40% of your profits. But it gets the message out there. You get, you know, a free review. You're getting sales you wouldn't normally get, possibly. Generosity within that sharing, you know, is really important. It works. Being generous really works. And then I guess what else would be another concrete tip? I think, you know, I mean, being on a number of different social media outlets, I think, is really important. Oh, the other tip that I'll do, the third tip, would be doing some giveaways, partnering up with some brands. That's what I find gets my biggest jump in sales. So, for instance, you know, I've developed some really good relationships with some food brands, like a coconut water brand, you know, for my sugar ebook, a stevia brand, chia seeds, a whole range of kind of companies who don't have the money to advertise, but they do have product they want to give away, and they want to give it away in the right community. So, you know, depending on what you're blogging about, if you're, you know, a stay-at-home mum blog, and you might have, you know, sort of, I don't know, some nappy companies, you know, who want to access your readers, you know, suggest to them that they get on board and do a giveaway. But make sure you monetize or give a money value to what is, I guess, a sponsored post. A giveaway post is essentially a sponsored post. Know what that is worth so that when you speak to these people, you say to them, listen, this is worth $2,000, $3,000, whatever it might be. Therefore, I'm giving you this, but in exchange, you know, can you give $1,000 worth of product? You know, it's a win-win for your readers, for you and for them. So that would be a tip I would really recommend. And whenever I post these, and of course you link it to buy a copy of the book today and you will get a $20, you know, package of chia seeds, you know, that kind of thing. It really does work. And it's, again, it's in that spirit of generosity. And, you know, I don't like grubby advertising or too many sponsored posts or anything like that. I won't have any advertising or any sponsored posts with brands that aren't, that I'm not naturally aligned with or that I wouldn't personally use myself. And that means that, you know, my advertising on my site is a little bit limited, but that's what I do. But this is a way of actually getting some of those brands that you really want to work with on board. And it's not grubby. It's a really authentic way to go about things. And make sure, as I say, it's leveraged to sales of your books. Don't forget that very important element.
Yep. I know you have to go in a moment. A couple of quick ones. Kyla's asking about pricing. Cheap price to get the reach or a more expensive price to perhaps get less sales but more profit.
Oh, look, I get all kinds of conflicting information on this, and I think that the prices that I've done for my two ebooks, the first one was $15 and the second one was $19. I'm really happy with the prices. I went with what I think it's worth. That is what I did. And I know that there are some people that couldn't know that find 19 bucks a little bit difficult. So I have offers, for people for early birds and things like that. I also have giveaways, that kind of thing. I think that it is important to price yourself where you think it's worth. I don't think you should downsell it thinking that you'll get more sales, because in the long run that you're shooting yourself in the foot. People will pay if they think that, if it's worth it. I remember once a meditation teacher said to me, don't undersell yourself, because people are happy to pay if they think it's worth it. And if you cheapen yourself by putting something out for $2.99, then I actually think that you come across as cheap and your product doesn't come across as worthwhile. I don't undersell yourself, I don't think. I mean, also don't overcharge, don't get greedy, but find that nice kind of sweet spot in between.
Yeah, that's great advice. Okay, what would you do differently for your third ebook? Is something coming in from Marsha?
Well, I guess I should say what I learned from the second ebook, for the second ebook. I mean, there's some things I can give, some practical tips actually, just things I've learned. Be aware of the fact that, or know whether you just want to sell as a PDF, which is, easy, you can just put that on your site and it can go out to everybody, or whether you want to engage or get in, involved in the whole EPUB, eMobi versions, which are then, the versions that are for e-readers. It is a completely different process, two totally different processes. And if you're thinking of doing both processes, I would highly recommend having the book designed and put together by somebody who knows how to do this. You can go to a wonderful little graphic designer to design a PDF version. But it will have to be completely undesigned to then become the e-reader version. And e-reader sort of converters, there are businesses out there that will take your original PDF version and turn it into an e-reader version. They actually have to then revert it, like they have to completely deconstruct it. So I guess what I'm saying is have a very clear idea of whether you want to do both versions, and you need to do the e-reader version to put it up on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. I would recommend it. It is a bit of an expensive process, but I recommend it if you're really going to go hard with your book. I actually learnt the hard way in the first e-book. It was designed as a PDF, but I had to hand it over to somebody. They had to undesign it, then redesign it. It was an expensive process, but the sales from Amazon and Barnes and Noble and everything are coming in now, and it's more than paid for itself. I learned from the second version. I went to somebody initially, and you can get her details from my various blog posts, and I will be doing another blog post that will highlight her services. She was fantastic. She designed it, both versions, and she tried to make them quite similar, so that you don't kind of get the e-reader version and get disappointed that it's a really kind of undesigned version of the PDF. And she knows how to do all of that. She knew the difference between the two. She could both design and she could also instigate all the back-end stuff. So that is something that I certainly learned. I would also say if you're going to put in widgets and fancy videos and all of that kind of thing, have them sorted out before you enter the design process. I put it in a few little tricky bits and pieces, and I decided to invent this shopping list device or widget, which had never been done before. And I found somebody in Tuscany, two IT nerds in Tuscany, who put it together. But I was doing that at the same time as trying to get the design sorted out, as well as having already committed to a launch date. And it really did create quite a bit of stress. So do that kind of stuff first. And I guess, look, there's probably not too much more I would do differently. because I really do think that the learning of it, the, you know, getting into the fray, entering the fray, making a mess of it is all part of it. You know, I learn something with everything I do online, you know, and I think you can only learn the hard way. And yeah, I mean, working remotely, having I've got a virtual assistant in India. I've got my, you know, the ebook designer in Italy, and as well as the programmers. It's not ideal, but I tell you what, it gets you very clear in your communication, and that's really a, quite a great skill to develop, is to get so clear in your instructions, because you can't kind of point to a screen and be organic about it. So yeah, that's a skill that I've learned, and it's a skill that I'm going to keep on learning, and it's a skill that I'll keep finessing as I go into my third ebook.
Great, thanks so much, Sarah. We've still got more questions coming in, so we may need to do another one of these at some point.
Is there one other question you wanted to ask? I know you've been very kind letting me dash off, but is there sort of a common question that people are wanting to ask?
I guess that there's been a number of people asking about work-life balance.
Yes. Good question.
Every time we do one of these, seems to be the big big question. You've got a lot on your plate. A lot of our bloggers, listeners have, you know, families, work, jobs.
Yeah.
Just a quick tip on getting that balance right.
Well, there's no magic solution. There is no magic solution. And I, as you know, my column was all about investigating and interviewing the best experts around the world, from the Dalai Lama to Edward de Bono to Tim Ferriss. I've interviewed everybody on this topic. So I should be an expert, but I'm not. And I can tell you now that even those experts, all those people that write the self-help books and the big blog posts on, you know, all of this kind of stuff, you know what? They are still struggling with it. So my first thing would be to say, don't worry, everybody's going through the same pain. My second point would be to say, keep experimenting and finding what works for you. I think routine of any sort is absolutely key. You've got to work out what routine works for you. And I know, Darren, you've actually shared a lot on what your routine is, you know, sort of in the mornings and so on. If it works for you, then just it's the consistency, I think, that really matters. Mm. It doesn't matter if you blog at midnight, but the consistency does work. The other thing I would say is a morning routine. Some kind of morning launch pad seems to be the common factor across everybody I've ever interviewed. And for me, my morning routine, it's a long routine, but it is my launch pad, and it actually ensures that I can be quite efficient throughout the day. I compartmentalize my day a little bit, in the sense that I blog and then I do other work and then I, you know, that kind of thing. You can't do too much of that, and you've also got to allow, when you're working on big projects, a whole day. You've got to have long slabs of time. Now, I know that's very difficult for people who've got children, but if you can find slabs of time and create boundaries, and I mentioned this before, creating boundaries is absolutely key to surviving in this new world of over-information. You know, it used to be about how well you could collate information, right? That was a sign of a successful career, when you could really collate great information, you knew where to source things, blah, blah, blah. Now it's the opposite. It's about how much information you can shut out. It's about having parameters and boundaries. You know, I think one of the best things that works for me is I shut off my email for big slabs of the day, and I try to do my email in the morning and the evening. And it is amazing how much the world can sort itself out without you being online. You know, I get to my emails at 5-6 o'clock in the evening, you know, I realise that most people have sorted out all the problems that they've been asking me about, and I don't need to reply. Get firm, firm, firm. Have boundaries, I'll rephrase that. In the past, we used to be able to sort of rely on our employer to create our boundaries. So we had weekends. We finished work at 5:30. We had a lunch break. If things got too much, you know, you could close the office door. That doesn't exist anymore. So we can't ask anybody else to do that for us. We've got to do it for ourselves. So my only advice is find your routine and what works for you, and also put up your boundaries and stick to them. And I think, you know, that if you can know that they're the only two things you can do, then that's what you can focus on, and stop fretting that you're getting it all wrong, because you're not. You know, we're all getting it wrong together, I suppose, is probably more accurate.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. I really appreciate your authenticity and your passion for what you do. And I guess at your heart is a desire to help people. And I think that's, you know, that comes through in pretty much every blogger I interview who's doing well. There's that sense that they're doing it not just to make a living or just to grow their profile, actually wanting to genuinely help people. And so I really appreciate that. Please check out sarahwilson.com.au and follow Sarah on Twitter. You also find on her site links to her Facebook page and Instagram and Pinterest and a variety of other places that you can find her. Check out her ebooks as well. They are great value. If you do want to continue to get notifications of these, we've just Jasmine's just told me that we've got Nomadic Matt Kepner's booked in for our next webinar, and we will be sending out details of that in the next week or so. So sign up for notifications of that. Matt's a travel blogger who I've met I met him at Blogworld once, and he's featured him in our Blogwise productivity book as well. So please thank Sarah, thank her on Twitter, thank her in the questions, and we'll pass them on to her. Thank you for tuning in. And again, thank you, Sarah. It's been great to chat with you today.
My absolute pleasure. And I'm sorry if I wasn't able to cover off everything. But I'll try to answer any questions I see on Twitter and maybe with a blog post on my blog a little later on.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you.